You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 11th of May, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at Radio Aryan. And of course, I'm joined by the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing today?
Another fascinating week, Sven. I've had to postpone part of 13. I think I'm going to move that now to 14. And I did a lot more research, and I'm certainly looking forward to finishing the research off.
You haven't been outside sunning yourself then, and taking it easy.
Give it a rest, will you? More important things to do than that.
Indeed. I think we've got an important episode tonight as well. We've got some really, really interesting stuff to get into. Just before we get into that, though, I'd just like to mention, I'm sure most of our listeners are already aware, 89-year-old Ursula Haverback has been jailed for 2 years. It was a suspended sentence, and they've got hold of her. Basically, she tried to avoid it, sought asylum somewhere, was unable to get that, and they picked her up and they put her in prison. She's actually been put in prison, 89-year-old woman, for questioning the official narrative of World War II. And we have got an address for her if anyone wants to write to her. You can find that on the RadioAryan.com site. It says write to our prisoners of war. Just click on that. It looks like a Christmas card because I put it up there at Christmas, but click on that and it's got all our prisoners of war addresses for you to write to. And she's now on there. And the second piece of news is Jez Turner. He was in court yesterday and he was in court today. And the verdict we're going to hear on Monday, and the courts played a really dirty trick on him. They didn't actually tell him exactly what the date was going to be that he was going to be in court. They just said it would be this week sometime. And then on Thursday night, I got an email from him. Wednesday night, I got an email from him saying that he was going to be there Thursday. And it was, of course, it was too late by then to get anything out on the radio. And I think they did that deliberately, in the hopes that there would be less supporters there. But apparently the courthouse was absolutely packed anyway. But we'll have news on what happened there next week. So two important court cases for our people this week. Ursula Haverback jailed and Jez Turner in court. So remember them in your prayers. Dennis, I don't know if you want to comment on that before we move into tonight's subject.
Well, to be honest, I can't believe that some people in, shall we say, our movement, think that the old lady is a shill.
I mean,
it's going, yes,
what?
It's going around, yeah, that she's not really one of us. And I can't believe it, to be honest, because this is a close friend to Ernst Nundle. It just doesn't come into my range of thinking, but it's true. And same goes with the other lady who's been jailed and whose brother sometimes gives a blast to the Jews. They're also saying
Monica
about him as well.
Monica Schaefer. How could anyone say that about Ursula Haverback? I mean, her husband was he was a part of the National Socialists, I believe. He was part of the NSDAP.
Well, and I couldn't believe it myself, Sven.
Wow! Some people. Yep. I tell you what, she's hell of a really, really elegant lady. 89
Plus,
years old.
Tremendous speaker.
Yeah.
On that panorama was to say it wasn't her first language.
She's a very, very intelligent lady and very, very brave. A really good example of the elderly of our race, I think. And it's such a shame the way that she's being treated. It's, you know, it's just so offensive to be putting an elegant lady like that of 89 years old in prison. You know, it just makes me furious to read about it, really. Just so angry and not knowing what to do about it. Well, one good thing I could say is, you know, that Count Dankula, who is a communist who's been speaking up for free speech and people have been saying, well, why haven't you been mentioning any of the British people that are in jail at the moment, like Joshua Bonehill for making jokes about Luciana Berger? He's in jail. And, no free speech for Nazis, of course, but somebody sent him the news report of Ursula Haverback, and he said, well, that's really wrong. Germany's free speech laws are terrible. So maybe he might mention it. At least, you know, he's got quite a loud voice now. But yeah, obviously we hope she's just released as soon as possible. And we hope Jez gets a good verdict on Monday. But to move to tonight's subject matter, we're going to be looking at why the Third Reich was called the Third Reich. And also, obviously, the Catholic inference from that, because the First Reich was the Holy Roman Empire. And obviously, the Third Reich is a continuation of the Holy Roman Empire. And
can I just say, Sven, I did a video just before The Great Story Never Told. I used to put little videos up with, you know, with decent music. And I just had a fascination about, you know, we were talking about it last week, about the salute. And so I put this video together. It showed the Roman troops giving the, you know, the arm, and then you had Mussolini, then you had Hitler. And it was just a neat little video. And this guy came on who was supposed to be like some kind of expert. You got to remember, I wasn't really that well up on the internet at all at that time. And he absolutely abused me. You know, you can't compare it to the First Reich and all this kind of carry on. And then the other day I realised they were right all along.
Well, it is, isn't it? The First Reich, the Second Reich, the Third Reich. It's all a continuation of the Holy Roman Empire. And what we've got tonight is based on a PDF. I guess it's about 60 or 70 pages written by Joe McGoebbels, obviously a pseudonym. But he's obviously put together a lot of information in that. We're certainly not going to be able to get through all of it tonight. And we've got some choice quotes from it. And hopefully we'll be able to use that as a basis for some future episodes, because he also goes into a lot of the Catholic saints and what they did to protect us against Jews and what they did to protect us against Muslims. And he ties it all in with the National Socialists. So it's an interesting PDF. But what really caught my eye about it, though, was this all about the imperial crown and the spear of destiny. And I guess listeners have heard of the spear of destiny because it's linked with an occult interest, isn't it?
But please listen.
Yeah. Well, what do you, first off, before we go into what Wikipedia says about the imperial crown and the lance, what do you know about these crown jewels? Because I'd only ever heard of the crown jewels of Britain. I'd never heard of crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire before. What do you know about them? How important are they to the Catholic Church, Dennis?
No, I mean, I'm a Catholic myself, you know. So, I mean, they are what they are. They're well over 1,000 years old. And apparently, what the story was they were kept in Austria for quite some time. And there was actually, I can't remember the scientist now, but he was really annoyed. He's proved many times that, you know, he thinks the Holocaust didn't happen, but he was really, going to town on one when he said that Hitler didn't have to use his army to go into Austria because he said it looked so bad. Well, when they went into Austria, he'd already sent in someone ahead to secure and make sure that the Rothschilds or whoever didn't move them. So they sent in an SS guy, and he was standing guard over them till the army came and secured the city. I mean, obviously what the scientists don't realise is that Hitler did have many enemies, and there were many times they were tried to be assassinated. And, you know, even though 99.9% of Austria wanted Germany to rejoin, you know, you're going to be right. So, consequently, they then moved them to Nuremberg. Now, I didn't know this myself, but you got to understand, all this has been hidden from us. And it's the reason why I'm doing the documentary, because it's all been hidden. And Nuremberg was the capital of the Holy Roman Empire. Always has been. So Hitler moved these Jews to Nuremberg, and they stayed there till the end of the war. But obviously, with the war coming, they hid them. And you're saying to me, Patton found them, which is not a bad guy to find them. And if Stalin found them, we won't see him again, will we?
No. I mean, that comes up in this quote here. So he moved the crown jewels from where they were in Austria. He moved them to Nuremberg, which was their rightful place, with Nuremberg as the capital of the Holy Roman Empire. And of course, all the speeches were at Nuremberg as well.
Of course, this is the trial.
Yeah, well, that's why they did the trial there. I mean, this is a part of the National Socialist history that, or a connection that we don't really hear very much about, because they want to push this idea that it was all occult. Well, let's have a look at what Wikipedia has to say about the Imperial Crown first. That will give us some information on it, because this was obviously very important to Hitler. It says the Imperial Crown of the Holy Roman Empire was the hoop crown of the Holy Roman Emperor from the 11th century to the dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire in 1806. So that's the First Reich. The crown was used in the coronation of the King of the Romans, the title assumed by the emperor-elect immediately after his election. The crown was made probably somewhere in Western Germany, either under Otto I, with additions by Conrad II, by Conrad II, or by Conrad III during the late 10th and early 11th centuries. The first preserved mention of it is from the 12th century, assuming it is the same crown, which seems very probable. Most of the kings of the Romans of the Holy Roman Empire were crowned with it, along with the imperial cross, the imperial sword, and the holy lance. The crown was the most important part of the imperial regalia. During the coronation, it was given to the new king along with the scepter and the imperial orb. The imperial regalia of the Holy Roman Empire, especially the imperial crown, were kept from 1349 to 1421 in Bohemia, which is now the Czech Republic, where the Karlstein Castle was built to protect them. I've actually been to the Karlstein Castle. Between 1424 to 1796, they were all kept in Nuremberg, Franconia, and could only leave the city for the coronation. Currently, the crown and the rest of the imperial regalia are exhibited at the Hofburg in Vienna, officially until there is again a Holy Roman Emperor of the German nation. And I think that's the important bit, isn't it? That's when they go back to Nuremberg, is when there's a Holy Roman Emperor of the German nation. That's why Hitler moved them to Nuremberg. That's the point of all of this.
Yeah. Well, let's not call it Catholicism and the history of the Catholics. Let's call it a cult, so nobody knows that it was an holy war.
Yeah, well, this is it, isn't it? He was a Führer, and he was hoping that the Pope would crown him as the Roman Emperor of the German nation. Now, I said that must have been the First Reich, but I'm not certain of that. Do you know exactly what was the First and the Second Reich? Was that the First Reich up until the 18th?
Charlemagne was the first one.
Well, that would have been about the 7th century. So this would have been the Second Reich then. My guess would be. Yeah, this would be the second one up until 18, whatever it is, and then the third one when Hitler took power. That's the connection with it.
Yeah.
Well, let's have a look at the Spear of Destiny, because this was also very important. The Holy Lance, also known as the Holy Spear, the Spear of Destiny, or the Lance of Longinus, named after Saint Longinus, according to the Gospel of John, is the lance that pierced the side of Jesus as he hung on the cross. The Holy Lance in Vienna is displayed in the Imperial Treasury at the Hofburg Palace in Vienna, Austria. In the 10th century, the Holy Roman Emperors came into possession of the lance, according to sources from the time of Otto I, 912 to 973. In 1000, Otto III gave Boleslav I of Poland a replica of the Holy Lance at the Congress of Gniezno. In 1084, Henry IV had a silver band with the inscription Nail of Our Lord added to it. This was based on the belief that this was the lance of Constantine the Great, which enshrined a nail used for the crucifixion. In 1273, the Holy Lance was first used in a coronation ceremony. Around 1350, Charles IV had a golden sleeve put over the silver one, inscribed Lance and Nail of the Lord. In 1424, Sigismund had a collection of relics, including the lance, moved from his capital in Prague to his birthplace, Nuremberg, and decreed them to be kept there forever. This collection was called the Imperial Regalia. When the French Revolutionary Army approached Nuremberg in the spring of 1796, the city councillors decided to remove the lance to Vienna for safekeeping. The collection was entrusted to a Baron von Hugel, who promised to return the objects as soon as peace had been restored and the safety of the collection assured. However, the Holy Roman Empire was disbanded in 1806, and the Reichslandodion, which is the name for all this connection, remained in the keeping of the Habsburgs. When the city councillors asked for the Reichslandodion back, they were refused. As part of the imperial regalia, it was kept in the imperial treasury and was known as the Lance of St. Moritz. During the Anschluss, when Austria joined Germany, the Reichsklenodien were returned to Nuremberg and afterwards hidden. They were found by invading US troops and returned to Austria by American General George S. Patton after World War II. Robert Feather, an English metallurgist and technical engineering writer, tested the Lance for a documentary in January 2003. He was given unprecedented permission not only to examine the Lance in a laboratory environment, but to remove the delicate bands of gold and silver that hold it together. In the opinion of Feather and other academic experts, the likeliest date of the spearhead is the 7th century AD, only slightly earlier than the museum's own estimate. Feather stated in the same documentary that an iron pin, long claimed to be a nail from the crucifixion, hammered into the blade and set off by tiny brass crosses, is consistent in length and shape with a 1st century AD Roman nail. So this has obviously got some history, and it talks here about it being the Lance of St. Longinus and then the Lance of St. Moritz. Do you know anything about that, Dennis, about these saints?
Yeah, well, the first one, I believe, was the Roman soldier who actually stuck it into Jesus' side to check whether he was dead or not. Instead of blood killing, it was covered in water. And he kept that spear. I think it was, he had real bad eyesight as well. And when the water went in his eyes, apparently it cleared up. And after that time, he just went around the world just preaching about Christ. And eventually he was made a saint. And then the other guy, I'm not so sure, I did read about it, but I read that much this week. You know, there's a... I'm about to forget something like, you know.
I think it ended up in Morris's hands after it was in Longinus's hands. I think that's the legend of it. And the nail that came from Constantine the Great, and that was added to it at a later time. So maybe what you've got is the whatever was left, whatever was made in the 7th century to hold whatever was there from the 1st century, that's what they've got now. And the bit from the 1st century is all gone, apart from this this pin, this nail that was apparently a nail from the cross. This is the thing people... Well, go on.
No, I was just going to say Queen Isabella of Spain actually sent some material for the museum so they could pierce that material with the spear. And then she took the material back and wore it close to her heart.
Well, I was going to say, what people don't realise, that you hear about these relics, and most people don't really understand them, but what they were taken as was proof that something happened. Like, as if you have forensic evidence, you know, in a court case, you have to have evidence. And that's what these relics were. So you'd have a nail from the cross or a bit of wood from the cross, or they would keep the skulls or the bones of these people so that they could say, look, these people lived, they did these miracles, these are their bones. And there are bits in the Old Testament where, like the body, I think it's of Elijah is touched and miracles occur from the dead body. So, you know, it's not to say this is some weird thing that was going on, because this went on in the Old Testament as well. Bits of saints could heal people. And that's continued. Yeah, it's continued right up until now. So these were important relics that have been with the church for millennia that Adolf Hitler saw as being extremely important, that he had hold of them and put them back in the rightful place. And we can hear about that in the next bit, which we've got from Joey McGurbles. Do you want to add anything to that, Dennis, about this Spear of Destiny or these crown jewels before we move
on? Well, I'm just thinking, I mean, I don't watch a lot of Spielberg, but I know that, you know, him and I think he had a few films where they went chasing, you know, the occult. And I'm just wondering if Spear of Destiny was one of them, which he kind of twisted, but... Maybe some people out there might know in the chat rooms.
Yeah, it might be. That seems to ring a bell. I know there was a band called Spear of Destiny as well. I think there might have been an Indiana Jones.
Hollywood's notorious for lies, as you know.
Well, they do like to twist things, and they do like to attack, you know, National Socialists, especially that Raiders of the Lost Ark. So it wouldn't surprise me. Was it Temple of Doom? That was one of them. And the Crystal Skulls?
Yeah, the Skulls, one of them, yeah. Sure, they're real as well.
Where the Spear of Destiny came in. Well, now we'll get to the bits talking about Adolf Hitler and his connection to it. And this bit's entitled Hitler Resurrects the Reich. And it gives us a bit of history as well. It says, back in 1424, Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund had placed the Holy Lance and the Crown Jewels in Nuremberg, where by royal decree they were to remain for the rest of eternity. However, they were removed in 1796 and later sent to Austria to keep them from falling into the hands of Napoleon. But Hitler had taken them from the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna. He brought these holy Catholic relics back to their traditional home. The Third Reich cannot be understood without knowing what had come before it. In essence, Nazi Germany was a feudal monarchy with Hitler as ruler. The Third Reich was a return to the Holy Roman Empire. Hitler wanted to become the next Holy Roman Emperor. He saw himself as part of the long line of Catholic emperors destined to rule Europe. It was his vision for Germany and his plan for the world. He eventually wanted to be crowned by the Pope, in the same way Charlemagne and Frederick the Great had been in the past. Therefore, Hitler needed the Holy Roman Empire's crown, the orb, the scepter, and the imperial sword for the coronation ceremony. These objects, the ancient imperial insignia, were sacred symbols of the thousand-year Reich and the dynastic succession of the Catholic emperors. The Holy Roman Empire crown jewels were ancient German symbols of Catholic monarchy. Their reputation had been formed by nearly 2,000 years of Christian mysticism and German legends. Hitler planned to resurrect Nuremberg as the imperial city of the German Reich. In speeches, he explained that Germany's brain was Berlin, its heart was Munich, and its soul was Nuremberg. So that sets the scene for it, doesn't it?
Well, there we're talking.
Well, what about this bit here where Napoleon was? Why was he worried that Napoleon was going to get his hands on them? What was the worry about Napoleon?
He had problems with the Pope Napoleon, and obviously he suffered later on. But at that moment in time, he were emancipating the Jews, and you know he was going all around. He didn't start the French Revolution, but he was certainly for it, you know, which was massacring priests and nuns in France. So there was a bit of animosity, and I think he got kicked out as well. I think, because he may have been a Catholic at one point. I think the church got rid of him.
Now, he certainly emancipated the Jews. I think he was the first one to do that. I'm not sure if there's some link.
I think he regretted it later.
Yeah, I think there's some link with him and usury as well. So obviously this needed protecting from him. Well, let's have a look at why Nuremberg was important. After Hitler brought them back to the city in 1936, Catholics flocked from all over Europe to see the treasures. Nuremberg's market square was renovated and renamed Adolf Hitlerplatz. Now, that market square is where all the pilgrims would go to in the past as well. Other projects included repairs on the city's town hall, the Holy Ghost Hospital, St. Catherine's Catholic Church, and San Lorenz Catholic Church, which was scheduled to become the Third Reich's National Cathedral. Hitler's plan for Nuremberg was to honour the greatness of the Holy Roman Empire and the storybook romanticism of the Middle Ages. The centrepiece of these renovation projects was the Nuremberg Castle, which was a symbol of medieval German greatness. The Knights Hall and the Imperial Residence were restored to their former glory. The King's Chapel was the most important project in the plan. In this chapel, the Holy Roman Emperors attended Mass, praying with the Holy Lance and the Crown Jewels. It was the spiritual centre of the city, where the Teutonic Knights protected the Crown Jewels. Hitler rededicated the King's Chapel to the Holy Roman Emperors and the Teutonic Knights who had worshipped there. Nuremberg was the city where hundreds of thousands attended Nazi party rallies each year. Young children welcomed Hitler's motorcade with bundles of flowers. It was where architect Albert Speer, in his vision of heaven on earth, created enormous temples dedicated to the sacred glory of the Reich. Now, it doesn't sound like someone who's, you know, trying to get rid of Christianity and impose a new pagan religion, does it, really?
No, well, I think what he was going to do, well, I mean, I'm pretty sure I know what he was going to do with positive Christianity. He didn't like the fact that there were too many Christian religions, if you like. You know, he felt that with all the Christianity splitting up like they are, that they're never as strong as if there was one. I think even in World War II, he would have got the Protestants, bang their heads together with the Catholics and everybody else, evangelists, call them what you will. And they would have had one Roman religion of Catholicism.
Well, I know that when he was talking about, you know, sort of religious freedom, he meant Protestant and Catholicism. He didn't mean anything else. He meant that you had the freedom to choose whether to be a Protestant or whether to be a Catholic, and he wanted them to support what he was doing. He didn't want the animosity between them, such as we saw happening in Ireland. That sort of thing. And he succeeded in doing that. That's why the church was pleased with him. Because there wasn't this trouble between the two of them. And the positive Christianity side of it, they were trying to remove the Jewish influence.
Exactly.
So, you know, some of the ways they went about that are, I would say, were questionable, but other ways that they went about that were definitely correct. But I mean, that's a noble drive to have, to remove the Jewish influence from Christianity. It's the same as you want to remove it from politics and from the media and everywhere. But this shows you that he was supporting the church and trying to act in confirmation with the way that the church had been before by resurrecting the Reich. That's why it was called the Third Reich. You can't get more Christian than that.
All this must have been going on behind the scenes, you know, because I don't know if you remember, a couple of weeks ago I said to you that the Pope was banned from the Treaty of Versailles, which was a Masonic celebration held by Rothschild, or hosted by Rothschild, 117 Jews. And so consequently, through that period of the Weimar, and you know, all the goings on, what were going on in Germany, the race mixing down in the Rhine Valley, and France and Belgium moving in trying to get the workers to do the work because they won't pay the reparations, there must have been somewhat going on behind the scenes, because 2 weeks, not 2 weeks, into Hitler's government, he signed the Reich Concordat with the Catholic Church. That just doesn't happen in 2 weeks. You know what I mean?
Now, well, remind us what that was, the Reich Concordat.
Yeah, what it was, basically, was Catholics had something like 23 million in Germany at the time. And he tried on like five occasions. He wasn't Pope Pius then. It was Eugene Pacelli was a cardinal then. And when Hitler came to power, I suppose the easiest way of describing it is handing everything over to Hitler. Because what happened was they took the education of the German children, you know, the Catholic Church, which Hitler was happy with. He was a Catholic himself. But what happened was, The national center parties, which were the, you know, known as the Catholic parties in Germany, Pacelli didn't like them. And he didn't like them because they were a democracy. Now, he's tasted Bolshevism in Germany when the Bolsheviks tried to take over. Remember the other week I was saying to you, I found some information where they were accused of being anti-Semitic. Well, apparently he didn't like these Bolsheviks and these Jews, what were in Berlin at the time, and he said so in no uncertain terms. So if you want to be called anti-Semitic for calling a group of Bolsheviks, then, you know, what's the world going to? But anyway, so he knew about communism. You know, he'd got the Spanish Revolution, mounting bodies, you know, the Russian Revolution, the priests, well, you know, mounting of priests and nuns. At the end of the day, there must have been something going on behind the scenes, because within 2 weeks they signed this deal. And what it actually did was, the church told the national centre party, which was, you know, the main Catholic one, to allow Hitler to become a dictator and then voluntary shut, which then meant all the Catholics then went into the National Socialist Party. So in other words, I suppose the simplest terms is Mr. Hitler, we're a bit worried about these communists. We think you're the only person in Germany capable of fighting them. So we'll teach your kids, but we'll pull out the politics, and whatever you decide, we'll be fine with.
You couldn't really get any better than that, can you? I mean, that's,
well,
I mean, it's really the Pope giving his blessing to the to National Socialism, isn't it?
Well, didn't Itchy say a few weeks back that fascism is the right wing of the Vatican?
Well, if you read what the Jews say about it, you know, they say there's always been a big link with Catholicism. And they say, you know, I mean, I'm always saying this, that the Jews see us as Christian. They see nationalism as Christian, and fascism and National Socialism, they see it as Catholic. And yeah. These are the reasons why. And this is why they promote the idea that it was following occult pagan principles, because they don't want you to find the truth out.
And then we're talking. I mean, the thing is, right, the Vatican, I mean, this is, it's got to be recognised. The Vatican was the first organisation to deal with Adolf Hitler within 2 weeks. They were also the last to deal with the ratlines. Because like I said a couple of weeks ago, could have turned their backs. They knew the war were lost. You know, could have washed his hands. I think Pacelli was a great Pope. I really do.
Well, they were the ones that saved the National Socialists at the end of the war, weren't they? By removing them out on the Underground Railroad to Argentina and South America.
Down to Argentina, yeah. But the thing is that it's been hidden. But when he brought the book out, Hitler's Pope, I'm using parts of that, of an interview in the next part 14, I think, where they talk about it, and he's blatantly anti-Semitic. But some Jews after the war tried to make out that, oh, he wasn't that bad. He saved a lot of Jews and all this kind of. Well, we know he saved a lot of National Socialists. That's a fact. But again, they don't want anyone to suspect what was going on in World War II. I've been saying this now for at least 3 years because they can't kill as many Christians when everybody knows.
Well, it does sound like there were things going on behind the scenes. I mean, there must have been for them to sign that concordat within 2 weeks of him reaching power. That shows that there have been communication behind the scenes. And what we've got here is we've got a bit of insight in that. It says, prior to the Nuremberg rallies in 1935, an expensive replica of the Holy Lance was created. It was presented to Hitler as a symbol of unity, stature, power, and strength of the German nation. Later, Hitler explained. Yeah, no. Well, I'm wondering who was it that presented that to him? Would that have been the Pope, or, you know, who do you think that was? 1935, that was.
I think Van Papen used to stand in for him at times. I can't think, to be honest. I'll have to check on that one.
It shows you that, you know, it was known that that's what he was interested in. He was going to be pleased with this, a replica of the Holy Lance, which is the symbol of being the monarch, being the Holy Roman Emperor. And this what was that night. This is in 1935 he was given the replica. Later, Hitler explained that the Holy Lance was a symbol of German imperial power. When Germany annexed Austria in 1938, Waffen-SS soldier Major Walter Buch disguised himself and travelled ahead to Vienna. He checked into a small hotel with a Luger pistol and secret orders to defend the Holy Lance or Crown Jewels at the Kunsthistorisch Museum. He was ordered to kill anyone who might attempt to take them before the stormtroopers could secure the city. On March the 12th, German troops entered into Austria. Buch changed into his SS uniform and protected the treasure. 3 days later, on the Catholic feast of Saint Longinus, that's whose spear it was, Buch removed the collection from the museum and presented them to Hitler. Buch raised his arm in a salute and announced, Die Heilige Lanz, mein Führer, or the Holy Lance, my Führer.
Well, so, now we know why they banned the salute.
What's the Roman salute? The Holy Roman Empire?
It's the Holy Roman Empire salute, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't want anything to do with the Jews.
And, you know, he's obviously thought ahead of this, and he's thought somebody might go and try and nab these jewels. It's obviously very important
to him.
That's
my thinking, isn't it?
A symbol of imperial power. And it wasn't just the lance and the jewels that he was interested in either. He has an entire collection of relics. After Austria was accepted into the Reich, the Austrian ambassador to Germany presented the treasures to the city of Nuremberg and returned the crown jewels to their real home. The Holy Lance and crown jewels were escorted to Nuremberg on a heavily guarded 8-car train. The treasure arrived in Nuremberg on August 30th, 1938. 1 week later, they were displayed in a special opening ceremony at St. Catherine's Catholic Church. Along with the Holy Lance and the crown jewels, Hitler gathered a large collection of relics from the Holy Roman Empire. These included the royal slippers, gloves, stockings, vestments, and the embroidered silk coronation robe of the Holy Roman Emperor. Hitler also collected the most valuable collection of holy relics outside of the Vatican. He had gathered a piece of wood from the True Cross, cloth from the robe worn by the Apostle John, links from a chain that shackled St. Paul, soil soaked with the blood of St. Stephen, and a bone relic of St. Maurice, the patron saint of the Holy Roman Empire. These were the sacred treasures of the Holy Roman Empire, which Hitler called the First Reich. Therefore, he considered them treasures of his Third and equally Holy Reich. Well, he must have had a lot of connections to be given all these relics, Dennis. I mean, just the fact that he had them shows that he was thought of by the church as a very important person.
Without a doubt. I've often felt, you know, I've been looking to research certain things, and it's been coming in dribs and drabs. We heard about the fact that in 1925, where they put the right across anti-Maria, right across Europe, because they were scared of the Bolsheviks, Catholic countries had organized themselves. You know, it's coming out in drips and drabs, but I honestly felt this week when I came across some of this material, the floodgates opened. I mean, there was another incident, right? I can't remember the city now. I think it's Trun, I think, in Germany, where after they signed the Concordat, they actually brought Jesus' robe, the robe that the Romans had thrown lots for after his crucifixion. And I think it was 2 million pilgrims visited the cathedral, where it was on display. And in the book, the Unholy Alliance, I think, came out about 1996, so it wouldn't have much good to say about the Third Reich. It did admit to being a scene from out of a movie, where you've got all these people queuing up overnight, you know, to see this once-in-a-lifetime robe, which Jesus wore. Like I said, 2 million from all over. Bear in mind, they would have had no idea what Hitler and the Pope would have known about the fear of Bolshevism and its imminent invasions. But anyway, besides that, you've got 2 million there, you know, and would you believe, I hope every pagan listening hears this next line, that the SS were standing on guard.
And was that the Turin Shroud, was it?
No, it wasn't the Shroud. No, this was the cloak, which they took off Jesus just before they crucified him, and the Romans drew lots for it.
Because I forget the name of that. I know there's the Turin Shroud, and there's something else as well. It must be the other thing that you're talking about, some veil or a cowl or something. I guess that would be a cloaked thing that he was wearing. You know, but just the fact that he has all these relics, And, you know, he's calling it the Third Reich, which implies that it's holy. I mean, he's the guy that came up with the idea that the first one was to be called the First Reich, and the second one was the Second Reich, and his one was the Third Reich. And it's not just that Hitler's got these ideas and he's, you know, collecting these relics and positioning himself to be a holy Roman Empire. But, you know, he's actually, you know, forming the SS based on the Teutonic Knights.
On the Catholic Teutonic Knights.
Catholic Teutonic Knights. Continuing.
But even then, they had that three generation thing. Otherwise, you couldn't join, just like the SS.
Well, I think it says that somewhere in this, in one of these quotes that we've got here, this is about the Teutonic Knights. During the Third Reich, posters throughout Germany presented Hitler as a Teutonic Knight, fighting to restore the medieval greatness of the Holy Roman Empire. The Teutonic Knights were originally known as the Order of Brothers of the German House of St. Mary in Jerusalem. They were created by the German Catholic Knights who defeated the Jews and Muslims during the Crusades. The Teutonic Knights were soldier priests who took vows to the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. After the Crusade ended in 1291, the Knights returned to Europe. Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II decided to use the order for a northern crusade into Eastern Europe. The Teutonic Knights led invasions into Hungary, Poland, and Estonia. Later, Emperor Louis IV gave them the imperial privilege to conquer all of Lithuania and Russia. Following the Protestant Reformation, the Knights largely returned to defend the Catholic Church in Germany. The Teutonic Knights were a major force within the Holy Roman Empire. They were trusted with the task of protecting the Holy Lance and the crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire. They stood guard in the King's Chapel, located in Nuremberg Castle, guarding the sacred relics. So it's the Teutonic Knights that are responsible for guarding them, and
we find it's the SS guarding them,
and we find that SS are following the same, you know, the same ideas and principles that the Teutonic Knights were, and that's what they said.
And that's why the SS was so bad after, because I mean, obviously they were what they were. It had been instilled in them, the Christianity, the Catholic thing. They were fighting priests, really, and so they suffered badly, as did. I mean, obviously, there were some Protestants in that government as well. They suffered. But the Catholics like Stryker and Julius Stryker and Goebbels, and, you know, if Goebbels hadn't shot himself, he'd have had probably a horrible death. And they've been demonized more than anybody. Klaus Barbie were a Catholic. It was just all unfolded in front of me. It was like, you know, winning the lottery.
Well, the Teutonic Knights, I mean, they aren't thought of very highly in the Baltic states, because they saw them as invaders. But
they
weren't Templars, and they weren't Freemasons. I mean, this was
exactly.
You know, this was an empire, and they wanted it based on the Christian rule of law, and they wanted Europe to be all following these same laws, and I guess really they wanted their European brothers to be benefiting from what they had as part of the Commonwealth. You know, that was a large part of it. I don't think it was about conquering people and oppressing them and turning them into slaves, you know, because that just doesn't fit in with what was being preached. You know, you can see what the Bible is, you can see what the Bible says, you can see how these people were expected to behave. They weren't slave masters looking to enslave people. They were looking to free people and bring them the good news of the Bible.
Well, we knew the slave masters there, don't we? Just with the financial system.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of these countries as well, you know, I mean, they were fairly backward at the time as well, before the Christians went in there and Christianized the place. And then they had castles and the same rule of law as everyone else and become a part of the empire. You know, if it wasn't for the church, nobody would even be learning how to read. It was the church that took charge of schooling.
Sorry, what this documentary's been trying to prove is the link between all these revolutions and World War II, because nobody actually thought of it as a holy war, which obviously Samuel Ultramar, thanks to him, you know, set us all off the same year when the Concordat was signed. So all this is all, it's tying all up. I mean, I think it was March when the Daily Express announced in the newspapers Judea declares war on Germany. I think it was April when they signed the Concordat. I think it was July when Untermyer declared holy war on radio WBAC. So, and that was never revoked, you know. And so my mate, you know, Mr. Freeman, tells us so eloquently of how the Jews, after being kicked out by Hitler, and had this meeting and then decided what to do. And then they decided to tell Germany to get rid of Hitler and to reinstate every single Jew and every single communist that Hitler got rid of. Or we will declare war. And they did.
It must have totally freaked them out. I mean, they must have thought, well, you know, we've got rid of the church. We've got our emancipation. We've got our democracy. We're having our revolutions. Oh dear. Here comes the church again. Yeah. Here comes the Roman Empire again. Yeah. Yeah. When they thought they'd,
it just all opens up. It's fascinating, really. I mean, the fact that, the Teutonic Knights were Catholic. Obviously, you know, the SS were based on them. So all these people say, oh, the SS were the occult. There's never been as much drivel in my life because this were allegiance to God. This were allegiance to Adolf Hitler. And they asked the question, what do you think of anyone who doesn't believe in a greater being? And they call him an idiot.
Well, let's have a look at the SS and the connection with the Teutonic Knights.
Come on, please.
The Schutzstaffel was created in 1925, giving personal protection to Hitler at public functions and events. Heinrich Himmler joined that same year and eventually took over the organisation in 1929. Under Himmler's control, the SS transformed and resembled the Teutonic Knights. Their official colours were black and white, the same used by the medieval soldier priests. In 1933, Professor Karl Diebitsch and Walter Heck designed new all-black uniforms, influenced by the same design the Catholic Knights wore in the Middle Ages. Heinrich Himmler told his officers, "Never forget, we are a knightly order." The Schutzstaffel had the same ancestry qualifications as the Teutonic Knights, requiring members prove their German heritage for three generations. The SS also began its own Northern Crusade, reconquering the same land in Eastern Europe that the Catholic Knights had taken. Most importantly, though, the SS officers and the Teutonic Knights were both given the important task of protecting the Holy Lance and the crown jewels of the Roman Empire. Now, I hadn't thought about that before, that they were going back into the same lands. And, you know, the people that are in the Baltics that complain about the Christian crusade, you Teutonic Knights coming in there and invading. Well, at least they did go back in there and liberate the place for a few years from the Soviets before the end of the war.
There might be some people out there who are saying, but Hitler wasn't the Catholic. Well, what the problem was with Hitler is a similar problem what I've got with the Catholic Church, is that, you know, today I look at it and I just don't recognise it. The seat of Rome is empty. Now, Himmler left the Roman Catholic Church for his own personal reasons. And he told the SS, don't follow my suit. I've left it for my own reasons. This is a Catholic organisation. Carry on, boys. So, consequently, that departure from the Vatican then leads us to the whole occult thing.
Just because Himmler left the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
That's just one of them. But he's, you know, the SS was based on the Teutonic Knights.
Yeah.
And as we're here, it was based on Christian ideas as well. I just find it interesting that they went back in and liberated the Baltics from them. And this also reminds me of there's a song that I've heard people, I think it's a Finland SS marching song. Some people have said before, oh, you know, this shows that they weren't Christian. And if you look at the lyrics and the lyrics in English, they talk about something about protecting the Holy Roman Empire or being the soldiers of the Holy Roman Empire and the eternal soldiers protecting it. And, you know, it's not talking about Satan at all. It's talking about protecting the Holy Roman Empire. It shows the link between the SS and the Teutonic Knights.
Yeah. I knew my dad were right.
They usually are. They usually are, Dennis.
Yeah.
But this, you know, this was an SS marching song. So, you know, even their songs were full of links to this.
Yeah.
And then with the next bit we got Vevelsburg Castle. Again, this gets talked about as being occult.
The centre of the occult, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Himmler renovated the Vevelsburg Castle, located deep in the sacred Teutoburg Forest. The castle became a masterpiece of late Renaissance architecture. It became the SS Officer Training Academy, where soldiers prepared for knighthood with spiritual and intellectual training exercises. Himmler was fascinated by the rites and traditions of the Holy Roman Emperors. A replica of the Holy Lance was kept on his desk. Replicas of the imperial crown, scepter and orb were put in glass display cases in the castle museum. Hitler named his personal section of the castle after King Heinrich I, his patron saint. He decorated his room with a medieval bed, armchair and suit of armour. He designed another portion of the castle for Hitler, which was named and decorated in honour of Frederick the Great. It doesn't sound very pagan to me.
Not at all.
You know, that's the castle that has
to be Hollywood in.
Well, that's the castle that has the black sun in it, and you know they've never really been able to say where that image came from, but it does seem to symbolise a passage in the Bible that talks about Christ being a light that no man has ever seen, and that's how you would depict a light that no man has ever seen would be a black sun,
the sun of
light that you couldn't see. Well, I think there was also. The round table with split up into 12.
Yeah, again, I think it was Last Supper.
Yeah, you got the 12 disciples there as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think they were interested in all of our history. And of course, you know, our history we had pre-Christian history as well as Christian history. So if you're interested in the white race, you're going to be interested in both. You're not going to be against any of it. You're going to be interested in all of it. I mean, I'm interested in all of it. You know, I'm not going to knock our pre-Christian beliefs. I don't understand why people that claim to follow them knock our Christian beliefs, because to me, it's all part of white heritage.
That's history, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
What interested me, though, they mentioned that there was a chapel in that castle, and when the Allies turned up, they took down the Latin insignia over the top of the entrance, as to the world not to be aware of what exactly the SS were.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. We've got some more here on the SS. The official motto of the SS was, "My honour is my loyalty, mine error height true." I think that's like, my word is my honour, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Like the Teutonic Knights, they took a vow, practised chivalry, and devoted themselves to God. As leader of the Schutzstaffel, Heinrich Himmler required his officers to read and memorize a book he wrote called 50 Questions and Answers for the SS Man. The first question is, what is your oath? The answer is, we swear to you, Adolf Hitler, loyalty and bravery as leader and Chancellor of the German Reich. We vow to you and to the principles laid down by you, obedience to the point of death, so help us God. The second question is, thus, you believe in a God? The answer is, yes, I believe in a Lord God. The third question is, what do you think of a person who does not believe in a God? The answer is, I consider him arrogant, stupid, and a megalomaniac. He is not suited for us. In 1937, Himmler explained, be in no doubt that we would not be able to be this body of men bound by a solemn oath if we did not have the firm belief in a Lord God who rules over us, who has created us and our fatherland, our people and this earth, and who sent us our leader. He further wrote, we have the holy conviction that according to the eternal laws of this world, we are accountable for every deed, for every word and every thought, that nothing our mind thinks up, our tongue speaks, and our hand does is completed with the act itself, but is a cause which will have its effect, which in an inevitable, inexorable cycle rebounds on ourselves and our people. in the form of a blessing or curse. Believe me, men with this conviction are anything but atheists.
I don't mind.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's really well thought out. Everything we do isn't finished with what you've done. The effects of it and the consequences
need to be
of
answered
it,
for, yeah.
Yeah, affect right, everyone yeah. else. Well, we're paying now for the actions of people 70 years ago. We're paying for yeah. fighting against Adolf Hitler. And, you know, in certain ways, we can't break out from that. The consequences are there. You can't change yep. them. You can't go back in time and change the cause. So you've got to put up with the effect.
Exactly. This is the way that it's not good, is it?
The fact that he's saying that and saying that there is a God that is watching us and that knows everything that we say and do, I mean, that is exactly what Christianity teaches.
So why do the Jews hide all this from us?
Well, it's, they certainly don't want us researching it, do they?
Not at all. They move heaven and earth. I mean, they could have quite easily gone right through the Vatican and wiped them all out. Because they did that with all the other priests. But no, they'll take the time. They got rid of Pius. They brought in the Freemasons. They brought in Vatican II. And they ever so slowly, but meticulously. But at the end of the day, that was a holy war. Just like the Spanish Revolution, just like Russian Revolution and the French.
You know, I think it's quite clear that it was a holy war. I think a lot of people on our side understand that it was the forces of light against the forces of dark. But some people get confused as to, you know, Christianity is the side yeah. of the light.
Well, some people don't even think the Catholic Church were Christian, which is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Well, again, that's, you know, that's a modern interpretation of it. You know, you could say yeah. At one time, for the first 1,000 years, the church was united. The Celtic church was one branch of it. What became the Roman Catholic church was one branch of it. And what became the Eastern Orthodox was one branch of it. And they did have a united belief system. That's why they called it Catholic, which means universal, because it was the same Bible that they were using. It was the same rituals that they were using. It was the same interpretation.
Usury.
Yeah.
Pornography.
All of it.
Yeah. And yet, but the Jews in the ghettos were, you know, they're looked after. They're probably safer than anywhere else. And then they're not let loose on the human race.
Well, they were kept entirely separate. I mean, that's where we get the term from beyond the pale from, because where they lived was beyond the pale. So anything that was really degenerate, right. You'd say, well, that's beyond the pale. But it wasn't until...
Also masonry as well, you know. No church, no other religious order has fought Freemasonry as hard as what the Catholics did. I think it was 1795... One of the Spanish Inquisition entered a lodge. He got the blessings from the Pope before he took that secret vow to enter. And when he came out, he produced a document called the Witches, Atheists, Warlocks, you name it. And so the Spanish Inquisition went to town. But I mean, that was what World War II was all about. They stopped the Pope going to Treaty of Versailles. They got the Bolsheviks as their full force, to about to rape plunder Europe. It's like an open book to me this week.
Well, there's all these parallels that can be drawn, aren't there? There's parallels between the Teutonic Knights and the SS, and then there's a parallel between the removal of the Jews and the Spanish Inquisition. And the banning of usury and the way that the church banned usury. And it wasn't until Constantine the Great took power that the Romans ever did anything about the Jews. Once Constantine the Great took power, yeah. you know, it was illegal for a Christian to marry a Jew. He banned the Jews from doing their usurious money practices. He banned the Jews from having Christians working underneath them. And eventually, the Jews just couldn't do any Jewing within the Roman Empire, so they moved to Caesarea. But it wasn't until the church took power in Rome that it was able to do anything about that. And maybe we'll get into the parallels between the Roman Inquisition and the removal of the Jews in a later episode, Dennis, because we've come to the come to the end of this episode now. But as I say, we've got plenty more that we can go into. Yeah, we've got plenty more we can go into from this pamphlet in the future. So thank you very much for coming on, Dennis. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Don't forget, we do require donations to keep the site going, and we have a Bitcoin wallet at the bottom of every article. And, of course, we do hope you all have a great weekend ahead of you, and we'll see you all again, same time, same place, next Friday on Radio Aryan.